Good morning. Welcome to House Ag and Forestry Committee. We hope to have some more members show up here in just a little bit and get them out of their offices. Things get kind of busy this time of the year. Today, we've scheduled an overview of a potential issue that may be coming down the road as an initiative. As you know, last election season, we had a measure called Measure 64 that would have addressed our current Forest Practices Act that we have in the state of Oregon. And there was rumor out there that there may be another initiative on the ballot addressing how we harvest timber in the state of Oregon. And so I visited with the people and encouraged them to come and talk to us about this issue maybe ahead of time. I think we've tried to do this in the last few years as we've seen initiatives come to the ballot. They get there. They've not really had any maybe legislative purview. When they've gotten there, they've run into a hailstorm of criticism. They've met court challenges and that sort of thing. And I think there has even been proposals that some way or another we could have initiatives looked at by the legislature, and they could either take our advice and go on, or take our advice and change their initiative before it gets to the ballot. And sometimes that would then not have the fact that people voting on something and then being upset because later it doesn't meet legislative overview or court overview. So I really appreciate this group coming this morning and telling us what you maybe have in mind and laying it out. And that way, I think we have an opportunity to pot shot at it, so to speak, ahead of time. You have an opportunity to fine-tune it, and it gives us a little heads up before you go into the process of getting all your signatures and going through all the work. So we have representatives from the timber industry sitting in the audience here today, all interested, and so we really welcome you, and nice to have you here today. So the group is called Respect Our Resources, and with that, I don't know what your program really. You're going to have some slides, I understand. Maybe you'd like to come up to the mics first and introduce yourself. The process, that's usually the way we do it there. We have a tape that runs, and so you need to introduce your name, introduce yourself, state your name. And I guess I'll turn it over to you. What do we have? Three people are going to kind of head this up. So probably all three could come up to the chairs here and kind of lead off. If you have any handout material, give that to Samantha over here. And do you have any extra? How many copies do you have just for the committee? You have extra copies?
25.
Okay, just hand out the committee, and then the extra ones we'll put back there on the table for people in the audience. And so anyway, welcome to our committee. This committee deals with most ag and forestry issues here at the legislature. We look at all of the natural resource agencies and their issues, forestry and fish and ag agencies. And so it's nice to have you here today.
Thank you. I guess I'm going first. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Rappaport. I'm here today to explain why many citizens view a ballot initiative as a welcome and necessary step towards improving forest practices on private timberlands in Oregon. Over the past 2 years, I've represented the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club before the Board of Forestry and the Landslides and Public Safety Task Force. I've also attended many of the Memorandum of Agreement MOA committee meetings that have now evolved into the current Forest Practices Policy Advisory Committee process under the Oregon Plan. Based on our experience while participating in and while observing these state processes, we view it as highly unlikely that other non-initiative processes currently underway, like landslides and public safety legislation, and the Forest Practices Advisory Committee, will produce significant and timely change in the way Oregon's forests are managed. We note the following. Both landslides and public safety and Forest Practices Advisory Committee processes are heavily influenced by the Department of Forestry. Both will ultimately result in rulemaking by the Board of Forestry, which also oversees the department. The question becomes, does this pivotal board adequately represent all of the constituencies that are deeply concerned with and affected by the future of Oregon's forests? We feel that the answer to this question is no, that environmental and fishing constituencies are greatly underrepresented on the Board of Forestry, on which 4 of the 7 members are connected in some fashion with the timber industry, and none are connected to fishing. We further believe that rules passed by the board will correspondingly reflect the timber industry's interests much more than those of the general public. The Department of Forestry seems to be highly disinclined to acknowledge that timber harvesting significantly increases the frequency of landslides from steep slopes. Since the 5 tragic deaths and landslides that initiated on steep, clear-cut hillsides in 1996, the connection between landslides and timber harvest has been a key issue in the ongoing discussion about how to improve forest practices. The Department of Forestry has maintained throughout the landslides and public safety process that timber harvesting on steep slopes does not significantly increase the frequency of landslides. This advice by the department results from its own study of the connection between landslides and timber harvest, which it undertook after the storms of 1996 and the tragic deaths. However, it is completely contrary to current best available independent science. Several independent landslides experts, Professors David Montgomery of the University of Washington and Bill Dietrich of Berkeley, testified before last year's MOA committee and sharply questioned the department's claim that forest practices on steep slopes increase the rate of landslides when you average over a stand rotation time of 40 to 50 years by only 25%. Professor Montgomery even presented evidence that forest practices on steep slopes instead increase the overall rate of landslides by 200% to 300%, a much larger number than the 25% offered by the department. The department never brought this testimony by scientists from first-rate institutions to the attention of the Landslides and Public Safety Task Force or to the public's attention, even though the department's landslides personnel staffed both the MOA committee meeting at which the testimony was given and the meetings of the Landslides and Public Safety Task Force. ODF, the department, was evidently unwilling to advise the task force on the current state of the best available independent landslide science. Unfortunately, ODF's advice on this matter will also be relied upon in the future by the Board of Forestry and by the Oregon Plan Forest Practices Advisory Committee process. For this reason, we conclude that the entire issue of the connection between timber harvest and landslides is highly unlikely to be adequately addressed by either Landslides and Public Safety or the Oregon Plan process. The process by which the Forest Practices Advisory Committee will arrive at recommendations on how to improve forest practices in order to recover numbers of listed salmonids relies upon the development of consensus between the timber industry, environmentalists, and anglers. However, one of the parties to this consensus, the Oregon Forest Industries Council, has recently stated that it does not feel that the recommendations of the Forest Practices Advisory Committee must live up to the requirements of the Endangered Species Act. I think an opinion sharply in contrast to where the public thinks this process is going. We regard the requirements of the Endangered Species Act as, if anything, insufficient to recover our state salmon runs. So we interpret OFIC's position as one of support for only very weak recommendations on how to modify forest practices in order to restore our state salmon runs. We note that OFIC can easily block stronger recommendations by the Forest Practices Advisory Committee by refusing to come to consensus. Thus, we believe that the Oregon Plan process will result, again, only in very weak improvements in the protections given to streams that course through private forest lands, insufficient even by the standards of the Endangered Species Act. Weak recommendations or not, the Forest Practices Advisory Committee process is also suffering from increasing delays. The committee is now considering issuing recommendations next November rather than this June as was originally promised. Based on past history, we expect more delays in the process so that it may well be years before the committee even issues the weak recommendations that, for the reasons I've indicated above, we anticipate. In summary, both these processes, the landslides and public safety one and the Oregon Plan one, seem to be headed towards producing only very weak changes in forest practices on the ground. For this reason, many citizens are very interested in another method, a ballot initiative, through which to reflect the Oregon public's desire that our private forest lands be managed in a way that fully protects public fish, wildlife, and plant resources. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. That's to sum up what you said, you basically addressed most of your testimony towards landslide issues and salmon recovery. Is that the way I heard that?
That's correct. These are certainly two of the biggest already underway state processes to address changing forest practices.
Okay. Any question, Aaron, before we move on, that you people have additional testimony? Okay, why don't you go ahead then? Whoever wants to take the next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have some hands up.
Okay, great.
I have 25 copies and I'll give them to the
committee. Please state your name on so we can get it. Pull that mic closer to you there. State your name so we can get it on the tape.
Thank you, Chair Wells. My name is Tom Giesen. I live at 122 High Street in Eugene, Oregon. I'm here as Tom Giesen, and I'm the coordinator of Respect Our Resources. Respect Our Resources is a group of citizens interested in forest practice reform, and our ranks include foresters, scientists, forest activists, and ordinary citizens such as myself. We appreciate the opportunity to testify before this committee, and we thank you very much for this hearing. As background, I'm also Tom Giesen, the president of Tom Giesen Consultant, Inc., a construction consulting firm specializing in consulting construction cost estimating for large commercial and institutional construction projects. I've been in business doing that in Eugene since 1980. One of the handouts that I gave you is a photograph of a tree with some loggers standing in the undercut. I give that not to suggest that we should be growing private forest trees to that age. The age is probably 1,000 to 1,500 years. The tree's about 25 feet in diameter. I passed out the photo to show you the kinds of trees that Oregon grows. It's the best place in the world to grow trees. And that tree, which, according to the photograph, is near St. Helens, Oregon, is an example of the incredible productivity of Oregon's forest land. I believe, actually, that it's not a fir, as noted, but a cedar, but it's somewhat hard to tell from the photograph. We're here, we of respect our resources are here because of the inexcusably degraded condition of many of our public resources. Public safety has been said by the state forester to not be the job of his department. We think that's nonsense. Citizens are being killed out there in the forest, too, this year in landslide. Public assets, roads, bridges, and other structures are damaged and destroyed by an unnatural level of landslides and floods, and they're damaged and destroyed with impunity by those who log heedlessly and build roads where they should not be, or by inappropriate methods. These issues on private lands are particularly critical now because fully 82% of the volume of timber cut in this state is now from state and private lands, since the federal contribution is very low now. In addition, our common assets, water, which ought to be clean, clear, cold, pure water, and air, which ought to be unpolluted, fresh air, and soil, the productivity of which must be protected long term, because our forests are no more than the soil on which they grow, and our fish, many of which, incredibly, are now extinct, and many more endangered and threatened, and our wildlife, many species again extinct, endangered, and threatened in this state. These resources have been trashed. And we are without hope, short of a vote of the people, that the will can be found to restore them. The process of degrading these resources has gone on for a long time, and we continue to face crisis after crisis without any substantial change. Public safety must be protected, and our common natural heritage, to which we have a right, water, air, soils, fish, and wildlife, must be restored. I'd like to provide a very brief illustration of some of our concerns about the condition of our landscape, and I'll do that through a few short slides. And I'd like to point out before I start that these are not photographs of the most extreme examples of anything, but instead they're the kind of stuff that you find riding mountain bikes on logging roads in the wintertime. That's where most of these were taken.
You took these shots, right, Tom?
Most of them, yes. This is a logging road. Thank you. This is a logging road just north of Green Acres on the Umpqua River. It's slid away down into a stream. This is a logging road where the downstream side is simply sloughed off down the hill. This is a photograph of a clear cut in which a slide originated. High up on the hill, you can see the bare areas and came down to a larger perennial stream. This is that same slide. You can see where that slide crossed the logging road. This is in the headwaters of Wasson Creek, which is between the Umpqua River and the Smith River. Wasson is a tributary of the Smith. This is a landslide off a road, again, north of Scottsburg, in the ridge between the Umpqua and the Smith. The same landslide. A landslide coming from an oversteep road cut. This is the Smith River. This is a fresh landslide that's from this winter. That's the soil going into the stream. Another landslide in a road corner. This is a riparian buffer on a clear cut on a fish-bearing stream, tributary, an unnamed fish-bearing stream, tributary to Swamp Creek, tributary to Wolf Creek, tributary to the Sayusla River. The Oregon Department of Forestry inspector was on site while I was on site and indicated that this is a legal buffer on a fish-bearing stream. As you can see, it's about a half a tree thick. This is that same buffer a little downstream. This is that same buffer farther downstream. And I call your attention to the fact that the logs in the sale had been yarded, and so the logs you see are blowdown from the buffer strip. You also see one of the trees in the buffer strip at about a 45-degree angle. My belief is that most of these trees will be down in a year or two, and I will follow it, and I will photograph it yearly. One of my concerns about this kind of buffer strip is that it's fairly obvious to everyone that it doesn't work. You go look at it and say, that's a buffer strip. That's supposed to keep that stream clean. That's supposed to shade that stream and protect it from landslides. I don't think so. So when you take smart people like loggers and you ask them to leave buffers like that, they become cynical loggers because they don't believe in the rules. It's fairly obvious this does not work. The same buffer, a root wad, and a tree which fell directly toward the camera. The buffer is not long for this world. This photograph and others illustrates one of the problems with plantation forestry and monoculture. There's a yellowing of the young plantation here on the upper right in the photograph and on the upper left, and that is very likely Swiss needle cast disease, a disease which appears to be very prevalent in monoculture Douglas fir reproduction in plantations, and it retards the growth of Douglas fir. It's particularly noted along the coast, and particularly along the north coast. Examples are the same, particularly up on the flat, right below the older trees at the top, there's indications of Swiss needle cast. Again, trees on the upper right and across to the center. The yellower one on the left is actually, I think, a chinkapin. I raise the issue of Swiss needle cast because the way we do things is to try and do the most efficient thing we can, which is to plant the tree we want to grow the most. It doesn't always work. Those examples of Swiss needle cast are actually on the north face of Prairie Mountain, just south of Alsea, Oregon, far, far away from the fog belt where Swiss needle cast disease was thought to be limited. What's needed there, of course, is diversity. This is a landslide between Monroe, Oregon, and Alpine, Oregon. It shut the road for several days in heavy rains earlier this year. It started in the cut above the road. The road's inappropriately designed, I believe, and it went down on the highway, which is between us and the slide.
Excuse me, Tom?
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Mr.
Is that a private road or a county road?
Let me go back to the slide. Mr. Chair and Representative Krupp, the road that circles down the hill is, so far as I know, a private road. And the road which goes along the bottom of the hillside is either, I'm sure it's a county road. It's the Alpine Cutoff. It's a paved road connecting Highway 99 West and the little community of Alpine.
All right, thank you.
One of the provisions, as you will see, of our initiative is some incentives and disincentives to grow older forests. And we wanted to show you what the forest we'd like to grow would look like. We're hoping that the result of our initiative will be that private lands will be grown to perhaps an average of 80 years before final cutting. What we have here are some slides of an 80-year-old forest, again, on the north side of Prairie Mountain. And we want you to look at it to see how different it is at that age. Forests begin to get interesting in 40 or 50 years, which is when they're currently being cut. And between 40 and 80, the stands grow out of the stem exclusion phase, and you get some light on the forest floor. You have some mortality that opens up light to the forest floor. The light in the foreground on this slide is actually from a road, but as you can see, the light penetrating into the forest, and that begins the development of an understory in a more complex and biologically diverse landscape. There are snags in an 80-year-old forest. And here you see quite a number of deciduous trees which are not in leaf at this time. These are taken this winter. More snags, more deciduous trees, and a lot of pretty healthy-looking Douglas fir. More of the same. More snags, some down trees, some mortality, a lot of diversity, and a lot of understory hemlock and cedar. More of the same. As you see, these trees are substantial in size, 24 to 30-some inches in diameter. It's beginning to grow the kind of timber that Oregon is capable of growing. There's no place in the world that can grow high-value timber like Oregon can. This is not old-growth forest. This is 80-year-old forest. Thank you. Thank you.
Any questions of the committee at this time?
I'm sorry, I was thanking for the lights. I have more information.
Yeah, we'll go ahead. Maybe some people might ask some questions right now.
Oh.
Representative Byer.
Then
we'll move ahead. We'll kind of intersperse here.
Good idea.
That'd be
fine.
Byer and then Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The roads you first showed with the slides, were those all appeared to be paved roads in the slides? Were those paved roads?
The first road that you saw is a BLM road, and it is paved.
Okay, so that leads to my next question: is whose property were these roads on?
The roads throughout the Coast Range that are not on national forest typically run through alternate sections of private and federal lands, BLM lands primarily. It's a result of the ONC process that you're probably familiar with, Representative Byer.
Okay, further question?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In your latest slides of your older mature forest, where you show gaps in the trees and different species, where were those forests? Because in order to get a stand of trees to have gaps in it and snags, number one, there's got to be management to get gaps in the forest, because Doug fir is going to grow in a dense stand in natural forests until much older than 80 degrees. It's going to be so dense that you can't even get light to the ground. So those forests would have had to have been managed then, somehow those gaps created in the forest.
In the slides that I showed, the last 10 or so, 8 or I think it was, there are two conditions along that road. The road where those pictures were taken is Hull Park Road. It runs along the north side of Prairie Mountain through the heads of several drainages starting in Toby Creek in the west. Some of those areas have been thinned, and some of them appear to be unthinned. I don't know the stand history of that. I suspect at least part of that area was subject to a stand replacing fire at some time in the past, 100 years or so ago. So you're quite correct that some of that forest has been entered and thinned, and some of it, I believe, has not. I couldn't find the stumps that indicated a thinning.
Go ahead.
Okay,
we have till about 10 o'clock. Session's 10:30, so we'll be here till after 10. And this one thing we have on the agenda outside of we do want to move the amendments on House Bill 3496. So,
okay. Reading some of the articles that I've written about your proposed initiatives with your incentives and disincentives versus large trees, old trees, and young trees, how would you approach this, and how would you get a stand in this so-called good, you know, diverse condition if you're going to give disincentives to people who are going to manage their younger stands by thinning them, that you're going to penalize them if they do that?
I'm not at all, excuse me, Mr. Chair and Representative Byer, I'm not at all intending to do that. That isn't part of what we're doing. I yesterday faxed up concepts for the Year 2000 initiative, and I thought that was distributed to the committee. Do you, in fact, have those?
No.
Yeah.
No.
We don't have any paperwork at all on doing comparison.
The document that should have come to your office is Respect Our Resources. Is at the top of the...
Oh, yes, I have it.
These are the concepts for the initiative.
Mm-hmm. You have another copy there.
Probably in my to-read file. I'm
sure that it has at least a few of them.
No, I don't get it.
So, Chair Wells and Representative Byer, I would call your attention to item 2 and to the last sentence of item 2, which says, thinning, but not in the protected riparian core, and not subject to disincentives or incentives, will be defined, allowed, and limited to probably 2 or 3 entries in the 95 years.
Okay, I guess that'll lead me to my next question. Do you believe in private property rights?
Of course.
So do you consider trees owned by a person to be their own property, and they should be able to use them as they wish?
Yes. We're not prescribing how they use them like any other taxing mechanism. We're trying to establish behavior that protects public resources. I also believe in the protection of public resources, Representative Byer. So what we need to do here is balance the right of an owner of land and of timber to do as they please, while at the same time protecting public resources. We allow smokers to smoke if they wish, but we tax tobacco heavily.
Trees are taxed heavily now, I might add. A couple more?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. In your riparian zone that you were showing there as being such a terrible riparian zone, the thing that the fish and wildlife people want is for the trees to fall into the creek, the root was to overturn, create pockets, create diversions in the creek. I mean, it seems to me that what you're showing is exactly what the Fish and Wildlife Department people want in the streams, is large woody debris.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, I agree that large woody debris is desirable. My understanding of the scientists' recommendation is that they want substantially larger trees than the ones you saw in the photos. But in addition, there are at least two other things that we've been told are desirable. One is the shading of the water, which requires standing trees. And these are the trees, as I showed you, are headed down. The problem, of course, Representative Beyer, is that when you grow trees in a dense stand and they're never subjected to wind stresses and they don't develop a lot of lateral strength in their root system, the trees respond to stress like humans do and develop strength in the areas of stress. What weightlifting is all about, of course. And when you cut a forest like that down to just a few trees, those trees have no ability to withstand wind. And so they head down. That's what's happening. I don't think that the riparian area over time will provide the shade required to keep the water in the creek cool, nor do I think it will provide the other function that's required, which is to stop landslides before they get into the creek. Large conifers are recommended for that process. They need to be standing.
Are you familiar with the tour that went through the Elliott Forest shortly after the 96 floods?
A tour that went through the Elliott State Forest?
Yes.
No, I'm not.
In that tour, the fish biologists determined that the best thing that could have happened to those streams were landslides going into the streams for the long-term basis, because it replaces the small gravels that are get washed out over time in streams.
In the decade of the 80s, I did a lot of work with the Eugene chapter of the Isaac Walton League in STEP programs. And I have a little hat that says I spent 100 hours out in the woods restoring Wolf Creek and tributaries to Wolf Creek. And we did a lot of work to put structure in streams and to capture gravel of the nature that you're describing. And I'm aware of the desirability of those things, many of which result from inappropriate logging techniques in the past. The streams were cleaned out, as you're probably aware, and the large woody debris was taken away, and the streams were essentially channelized. And so certainly it's true that a certain amount of gravel needs to be returned to the streams and captured in the streams before it washes through. The problem is the sediment that comes with it. And so what we need here is a balance between capturing the gravel that moves through the system and preventing sediment from strangling the eggs and the young in the streams. So I'm certainly familiar with the concepts that you're describing as resulting from a tour in the Elliott after the 96 floods. But I'm aware that other things are needed also.
Maybe one more?
One more.
Mm-hmm. Why were those streams cleaned out and channelized large woody debris?
I can't speak to the motives of the people who did that. I understand that early science with regard to fish indicated that that was good. It was sort of what we did in the early days. We cleaned out streams and we put concrete on the banks and we got the water out of there. We didn't want floods, so if you get the water out of the terrain quickly, then it doesn't build up and cause floods. So you're asking me to speculate. And
well, I can speculate for you. They were done because it was required by the state.
But there was a reason the state required.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question, sort of being a city slicker, is you mentioned that the age of that forest on the last couple of slides that you showed was around 80 years old. How is that determined? Is that determined because of stumps that are left and being able to see what the age of the trees are that way, or estimation, or
in the case of that forest stand on the north side of Prairie Mountain, that was done through increment borings. And increment boring is the process of boring a hole in a tree and removing a tiny core in which you can count the rings.
Hmm, okay. And one of the things that you, if I may, Mr. Chair, follow up, one of the things that you also had talked about was diversity, the need for diversity in the forest. I didn't see a lot of diversity there. Is that a forest that had been planted by someone, or was that sort of a natural phenomenon?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, I can't answer that. I don't know the exact history of that forest. My belief is that a substantial part of it resulted from a stand replacing fire 80 years ago or more, and I believe it's natural, but I can't really say that.
If I may, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think he's referring to the slide that showed the Swiss needle cast. And then those were about 10, 15-year-old.
Oh, excuse me.
10, 15-year-old replants.
Yes, that's correct. And I'm certain that those were planted, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay. Thank you. With regards to low-income housing or affordable housing, it seems to be, you know, in the metropolitan area, it seems to be a big issue. How will the management of the forests affect the affordable housing issues in our various metropolitan areas? And particularly, I guess I would point out with regards to your tax that you're talking about placing and that sort of thing.
My assumption is that what you're assuming is that the cost of lumber and plywood and other forest products would rise and become an impediment to the construction of such housing.
That's exactly what I'm implying.
Yes. My whole business is construction cost estimating, and what I'm aware of is that the cost of lumber is a small part of the cost of construction, cost of lumber and plywood, and cost swings which seem great to those of us familiar with lumber and plywood, $100 a thousand, for example, is actually a small swing when the product we're talking about costs $300 to $500 or $600 a thousand units. What I'm aware of about the cost of lumber and plywood is that it varies much more greatly with the price that people from the Asian market are willing to pay for export logs. And what I'm aware of with the cost of construction generally is that the interest rate has much more effect on whether we can build very low income housing, and that the cost of land and the availability of urban land to put that on and so on. I believe sincerely that we'll have a difficult time tracking the cost in the change of lumber and plywood as a result of this initiative.
Thank you.
President Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand here in terms of bringing this to be the policy of the State of Oregon regulation, non-federal forest lands for the public health and safety.
I don't believe Tom has gotten into this yet. Would you like to go ahead and explain this? I think maybe we need to have him go ahead and explain it, because we really haven't talked about. I'm going to limit the questions here right now to what we saw on the slides and that sort of thing, and then I'll get into what they're proposing.
And then I'll reserve my question.
That'd be great. And let's go ahead and talk about you people are proposing to solve some of the problems that you see out there in the way that we're running our forests.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So because of the urgent need to restore our public assets to health, we'll run an initiative in the fall of 2000 which will do the following. And again, I refer you to the document that is titled Respect Our Resources. Concepts for the year 2000 initiative. It is in a legal drafting process. Many of the details will change. None of us are experts in tax law, for example, and so we're hiring attorneys who are to deal with issues with which we're not familiar. First, we'd like to revise the Department of Forestry and Forest Practice Act goals as follows. that it would be the policy of the state of Oregon and the regulation of non-federal forest lands to protect public health and safety and to conserve and restore public resources. These public resources include air and water quality, soil stability and productivity, fisheries and wildlife, and their habitats. This policy is to be achieved while at the same time encouraging a continuous and sustainable yield of high-quality timber and non-timber forest products from each forested watershed of the state for the benefit of the citizens of Oregon. We want to shift the direction of the department to take care of, first, public safety, that would be secure in our persons, and secondly, to take care of our public assets, water, air, fish, wildlife, soil productivity. And we want also that Oregon produce a sustainable flow of high-quality timber. That's where we want them to focus. Secondly, we'd like to extend rotations. Rotations is a forester's kind of term. It's kind of a complicated and weird idea. Basically, the rotation length is the period between final cutting. We'd like to do that through a revenue-neutral incentive and disincentive plan. Our first target is to get private owners to grow to about 95 years. We'd like to encourage that by providing a disincentive for every year short of 95 years, the owner of a tract being cut pays a disincentive of a fraction of a cent, and the amount here isn't important, but let's say a third of a penny a board foot per year. Thus, an owner who cuts at 50 years pays an additional $150 per 1,000 board feet or thereabouts to the state. And the state would then take that money to fund voluntary conservation easements in which owners receive some amount of money, say between $500 and $1,000 an acre, and the state would pay that to them at about stand age 45 or 50 if the owner agreed to grow the trees to 95 years. And perhaps would provide another payment at 95 years if they agree to grow the trees to, say, 130 years. These payments are meant to cover them for some interest lost, the opportunity lost of the money if they were to cut at age 30 to 40, which is what's happening now. And thinning, but not in the protected riparian area and not subject to disincentives and incentives, will be defined, will be allowed, it will be somewhat limited, maybe two, three entries. One of the things that we're trying to avoid are repeated entries, repeated compactions of the soil, repeated disturbance of the forest floor. So we'd like to allow thinning, but we'd like to minimize the disruption that results from that activity in the forest. Third, we know we need to protect riparian areas. So first, we'd like to protect a substantial no-cut, no-entry core area. We're corresponding with fisheries scientists at this time to see if our long rotations, which leave a substantial forest on the landscape, will substitute for the outer layers of riparian protection advocated by National Marine Fisheries Service and others. Because most of the riparian protection right now is fish-driven, and the assumptions in these various plans are that the landscape, most of the landscape will be cut every 30 or 40 or 50 years, and it will be then for a period of some years denuded. If the average forest age out there is 40 instead of 20, in other words, if we're cutting on an average of 80 years instead of 40 years, then there's a substantially greater forest out there, and we suspect, but we don't know yet, that that would substitute for outer layers of riparian protection. The core area is likely to be 50 feet on each side from the channel migration zone if outer protection is required, we don't think it will be, and 75 feet if nothing except long rotations are required in the outer zones. The above applies to all perennial streams, and intermittent will be the same, or perhaps the advice from the fisheries science will be that our older forest, older average forest, would suffice, and we think that that will be the case. But again, we don't have confirmation of that yet. fisheries issues are driving most of the forest protection efforts, as I'm sure many of you are aware. And so scientists look at us blankly and blink several times when we say, well, we're going to have an older forest on the landscape. They say, oh, you are. We're not used to that. So they're not quite sure how to react just yet. Fourth, we want to protect unstable slopes, either via prescriptions, but probably via disincentives, that is, taxation. We're cutting steep slopes, slopes over 70%, or unstable slopes. Fifth, we'd like to exempt small woodlot owners via a volume per year, maybe 100,000 square board feet or something like that, which would be exempt from the disincentives. But the volume cannot be taken from riparian core areas or steep slopes. And sixth, we'd like to repair roads. Roads, as again, I'm sure you're all aware, are a major contributor to landslides. They're worse than clear cuts. They're the worst thing on the landscape. This is still in discussion within our own group, but it appears to be an essential part of water, soil, and fish protection. And we would like to direct the Department of Forestry to get roads repaired, either up to the NIMP standards in their draft plan, or if that's not possible, up to the standards in the TFW plan that is likely to be adopted in Washington and has been accepted by the industry in Washington. In Washington State, that's right. And I would point out that riparian protection, road repair, and landslide protection has been accepted by the industry in the state of Washington, just north of us. Same general ecosystem, same general kinds of trees. So we're not advocating radical ideas here. We're just trying to extend what has already been accepted in neighboring states. Washington is the most recent. California has more stringent protections on streams than in other places than Oregon does. Oregon is the laggard in this protection at this moment. What, in general, we'd like to do is to reward the behavior that protects public resources and penalize the behavior that harms public resources. Landowners are still free to do what they wish. Landowners can cut early, they can cut late, they can cut at 2 years if they want to cut seedlings. That's their business. They can do it however they'd like to do it, but there are consequences, there are financial consequences. And call it a sin tax if you like, whatever. We need to take care of the public resources, our air, our water, our fisheries, our wildlife, our soils and their productivity, our future, and our current health, and we need to take care of those things.
Hey, are you ready for questions on this, Tom?
Yeah.
As soon as you finish this, then we'll open up for questions on your plan.
Okay. I have one final statement I would like to make. I can say that to the left, if you'd like, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you stop here, and
all right.
Representative Hill, we'll look at your proposal here now. And Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of the where you start and restore public resources, what do you define as public resources?
In this context, certainly I define public resources as air, water, fisheries, wildlife, and soil productivity. I think also a public resource is being safety, something we want, but it's not a natural resource in the same sense. So the first five are the critical ones for me, Representative Hill.
So how do you, how do you balance out in terms of the relationship of a single tree on a piece of private land and its relationship to public resources?
I guess, Mr. Chair and Representative Hill, when I fly in an airplane and I'm looking out the window down at the wing, if I see a rivet missing, I don't worry very much about that. And in the same sense, I don't worry about a single tree when I see it on a piece of private land. It's in the aggregate that things matter, and they seem to cause alarm in me. When I look down the wing and there are a lot of rivets missing, I get alarmed. And when I see a lot of trees missing in the landscape and being only grown to a short age, then I get concerned about that also. It's the aggregate consequences of this kind of thing that are the problem. So when that single tree is multiplied by a lot of trees in a whole forested landscape, when we're talking about 5.7 million acres of land in Oregon that's owned by large corporations, not small woodlot owners, and that's all being managed on a 30 to 40 year rotation, then we're talking about a lot of rivets in the wing of the airplane. And I get nervous, and it imperils the safety of the whole enterprise up there flying along at 30,000 feet.
So into the second section here, you're suggesting in terms of how are you viewing to bring in this incentive? Because we would have stands of trees that may be approaching the 50-year cutoff in terms of where are you suggesting in terms of the payments that would be made to landowners? Would it be existing land? So in terms of your initiative goes, voters put it in.
Oh.
And somebody who owns a stand says, my trees are at 50. Sure, I'll not cut them. I'll commit not to cut them to 95. Where does the money come to pay them this money?
I think we need some explanation of kind of the mechanics of how this money thing would work and who's going to handle the money and how do you transfer and how do you run this whole operation?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hill, I believe that this would be like any other revenue operation in the state. It would be run by the Department of Revenue. But I don't really, you know, these are things that you folks know how to administer better than I do. And that's what...
But you're running an initiative. I would suggest that you take the care to figure that out before you go throw it on the ballot and suggest that, hey, we've solved the problem. But, I mean, this is one of those fundamental problems in terms of you could have a 5.7 million acres of land that people could show up and say, pay me $500 to $1,000 an acre. I do the math on that, and I can't figure out where the money comes from. You assume that there will be people who will still cut their trees, but we have to live with the reality that they may choose not to, and therefore we would then have an obligation to pay them money. And where does that money come from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, I'm sorry, I wasn't quite finished with the statement I was making. While I don't personally have expertise in tax law or administrative issues, that's why we're consulting attorneys, and that's why the drafting is being done by experts rather than people like myself who perhaps don't know as much about tax laws as I should. So we're trying to be responsible in the drafting of the initiative. And certainly the kinds of issues that you raised are critical issues. I don't believe that there's 5.7 million acres of land out there approaching 40 to 50 years of age. So I'm not going to multiply those numbers out and tell you where that money's coming from. I believe instead, actually, that there's a substantial amount of ground that's clean within 10 years of being cut. And that there's a mix of trees out there, a mix of landscape that has trees on it between 0 and 40 years of age, relatively little that's over 40 years of age, or 50 years of age. Some owners like Starker Forest are growing trees now with a target of 75 years for clear cutting. Those are the exceptions. We're just talking 65,000 acres there as their total holding. Some other owners are doing the same kinds of things, which we applaud, but that's the minority. We believe our mandate to the Department of Forestry and the Department of Revenue will be to produce about 2 acres of ground that would grow to 95 for every acre that would be cut earlier. So we're going to ask them to adjust the rates such that that will happen. And it's difficult to predict what the circumstances will be in the market at the time, and the market keeps changing. And so this needs to be a flexible plan that responds to realities on the ground, the stocking of the forest, and so on. The principle, I think, is very simple. You provide disincentives for cutting earlier and incentives for growing longer, and the Department of Revenue and the Department of Forestry will need to adjust things so that this will work out. Again, the target is to get an average age out there at final harvest about 80 years.
Mr. Hill, if I may respond just briefly to that, too.
Have you stated your name for a tape?
No, sir, I haven't.
State your name.
My name is George Hutchinson, and I'm from a little valley just a little bit to the west of Medford called Griffin Creek. This group is not locked into the conservation easement concept. It's where we've gotten so far. But what we are really interested in is fairness for private property owners and simultaneously protection and maintenance of our public resources. So the type of question you just asked, I personally find extremely informative, and that's something we go back to a group of economists and say, fellas, what if? And we go back to a number of reference sources we have on how much of Oregon's land is in what state of timber. What is the level of maturity on these various stands? Now, this group is made up of and has done hearings and research for the last 3.5 years all over the state, starting with a number of environmental groups and ending up at the Oregon State University working with a number of the professors there in the Department of Forestry. So we're trying to do a very thorough job of researching both in forestry issues, in stream and wildlife biology issues, in fish biology, in economics, and the whole idea of ownership of private property. We've worked a lot with small woodlot owners, and by small, it's probably some of these folks own 500, 600, 800, 1,000 acres.
Is that it, Representative? Representative Umerloff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume that as we have this discussion about this initiative, that you welcome input also. And one of the things that I was thinking about is Representative Hill asked his question and your response. You did touch upon the market. Well, most of us in our lives, many of our decisions are economic decisions of necessity many times. And I was looking at your proposal, and I find some very intriguing ideas in here. But one of the things that kind of concerned me is you would be using the money that people were penalized when they were penalized if they cut before a certain year. You would be using that actually in your incentive program. So you have to make sure that there's a flow, a continuous flow there. Well, if the market goes bad, and we do have cyclic markets, and this property owner says, well, I'm going to suffer a loss if I sell in this market and also have to pay the penalty. And so if you're going to do this, you're going to have to build in to the plan something that would cover that, because you would be stopping a flow of dollars that you were going to be using for incentives. And you can't expect, I think as Representative Hill pointed out, too many times we get initiatives and they sound wonderful and then the state ends up paying for them and our dollars keep shrinking. So you would have to build some flexibility in here, and I'm not sure what it is, but as you approach this idea.
Mr. Chair and Representative Werbelow, this is intended to be flexible and to respond to the market. And as I indicated to Representative Hill, the directive is to the Department of Revenue and the Department of Forestry won't be to charge a certain rate, but will be to do two things. One is to produce 2 acres of older land for every acre that's cut early, or about that, and also to make it revenue neutral. So both of those things have to be balanced, and it will be a fluid process. Certainly we recognize that we have to respond to market conditions, and I thank you for your comments.
I skipped over Representative Thompson a while ago.
I'll defer because I see hands up all over the committee.
Representative Decker, you have
right down the line.
Oh, you didn't have your hand up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Representative Byron and Representative.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Do any of you own any timberland yourself? Have you ever sold a log to a log sawmill?
I have not.
I own timberland, but it's not ready to harvest yet.
Okay. The reason I ask the question is because you're in theory, you know, you've got this incentive, disincentive, going old tree, young tree, but in reality today, most mills won't even accept a large log. If they do take it, they will pay you a very reduced price for the large log. But many mills now, they won't even accept a large log. So where it's very nice to think that we're going to be doing this, where am I going to sell my log?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, one of our concerns hasn't been the market at domestic mills for larger logs. Our concern has been the condition of the export market, which is where the higher quality, larger logs have been sold in recent years. That market's currently down, but it's a highly volatile market and could go up substantially. It's one of the drivers in the recent $50 or so a board foot rise in the price of Doug fir logs in Western Oregon, but a minor part of that. Export markets have for many years now from private lands taken the best logs because they're willing to pay higher prices that can be obtained on the domestic market. I don't think finding a buyer for high quality log is a problem in Western Oregon.
In Southern Oregon, an 80 to 90 year old tree is still only going to be any somewhere between 18 and 24 inches more than likely. That's not a very large log at all.
Right. And that's not the reality when you're growing trees. An 80 year old tree is going to be much more than an 18 to 20 inch tree. Unless,
not where I live.
Unless you have a forest that is so open. And in order to get to that, you have to thin it very heavily, which you are talking about disincentives if you do that. So on one hand, you want to have an open forest, so you got much more diverse species. On the other hand, you got to have, in order to do that, you got to thin it. But if you thin it and get that open forest, you got a large log you can't sell. So the landowner is now between a rock and a hard spot, so to speak.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, if you thin, you do not. In get into disincentives. Thinnings are exempt from disincentives.
Two times what it says in your literature.
And I've also testified today that that's an approximation 2 to 3 times. What we're trying to do, as I indicated earlier, is to minimize compaction and soil disturbance.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to that as well?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I would anticipate that as more large logs come online over a several decade time period, that the domestic milling industry would adjust to that in the same way that it has adjusted to fewer large logs available over the last 20 years.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions, if I may. How many board feet are there to an acre?
That's a question of sharing, Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell. That's a little bit like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. It depends on what species and what site class, how good a stand it is, how old the stand is.
Soil, water.
There are too many variables for me to be able to answer that question.
Okay. Well, the reason why I asked the question is that I'm trying to figure out is that if you are disincentivizing at approximately $150 per thousand board feet, then an owner can receive $500 to $1,000 by agreeing to let their forest grow. How that's going to play out, because if, for example, I have a 100,000 board feet that I can sell at, I don't know what's it gonna sell for, but let's say it's $1 each, that's $100,000 probably, but I can get $1,000 an acre, then it's going to depend, because the return on my money, quite frankly, is quite greater by going ahead and cutting and investing the dollars as opposed to not cutting and letting it grow.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, let's take a specific example, a theoretical example that comes from a computer model of Douglas fir stands, pure Douglas fir stands. Let's say it's a site class 3 or a site class 2. That's sort of in the upper mid-range of the ability of a site to grow trees. It's in the coast range. At age 30, there's a Scrivener volume of not quite 18,000 board per acre, and the price currently is before logging costs and other costs is perhaps $550 to $600 a thousand times that 18 or 19,000. So
18 or 19 is what you said?
Right. Thousand? Just a little less than 20,000 board feet per acre. So the $150 times 18 or say 20, you know, is a lot of money.
Follow up, if I may.
Could I, Mr. Chair, could I give Representative Crummell some non-computerized numbers?
What is it for more than
that? Realized numbers?
Sure, go up.
80-year-old stand, thin twice. The kind of site 3 you're looking at is probably going to have about 30,000 board feet on it. 30, maybe 40 at the high end. And the $550 to $600 figure, that's current price for... You would never get that out of a 30-year-old tree right now. But.
So say $550 per thousand?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And a follow-up. With regards to nature's, well, first of all, would you agree that nature's use of fire is similar to man's use of clear cutting?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, I would not. There's a substantial amount of, there are quite a number of differences. One is that there's a substantial amount of organic material left on the site after a fire, whereas in clear cutting, virtually all of the organic material is removed from the site and what's left is burned often. Secondly, fires behave differently and more selectively than clear cuts do. Clear cuts are, by definition, clear cutting, everything's gone. But if you go to a natural forest and see how it burns in patches. Some areas crown out, some don't. The exception is the fire that crowns out and roars across the whole landscape. That certainly does happen, but natural fires are highly variable.
It is the reason why they burn in patches, though, is that because we step in and try to put them out?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, I don't think that's a generalization that you could make about the way fires grow. When the Silver Fire happened in the Siskiyou region, that fire was studied extensively, and what was learned from it is that the fire that burned most uniformly and hotly across the landscape was a plantation fire, the fires in reprod. But the fires in the natural landscape scattered about, crowned out here, didn't there, spared this. It's a very puzzling process to examine exactly what happened in a natural fire. The most susceptible landscape is the plantation.
The Yellowstone fire is perhaps the largest fire that's happened in the West in the last 10 years or so, and that burned with almost artistically beautiful mosaic patterns. You'd have a finger going in here and a big patch over here and then a large island with burns all the way around it. It was very, very interesting to look at from the air.
Thank you.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, let me just be crass. Is this a cleverly crafted initiative that will put such a financial disincentive on timber owners that they wouldn't be able to afford to cut their timber, so that you can go out and market this initiative as a we're being friendly, we understand, we want to respect private property rights. They can still cut their trees, even though that it would be such that they wouldn't be able to from an economic standpoint. So the effect of this is, hey, you got to wait to at least 95 before it becomes financially capable to cut the trees, which then gives, you know, 40, the average age is 30 or 40, is it 50 years before anybody really wants to bring their trees into the market?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, I have several responses. The first is that I hope that it is a cleverly crafted initiative. That's certainly, we'd like to be clever in the way we do this. Secondly, there is no intention in this initiative to do anything except extend votation ages and protect public resources. There's no intention in this initiative to shut down private industry forestry. None whatever.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
Even if the, you know, since we don't know yet, you're still, quote, you know, working out in terms of what the disincentives are, in terms of, but if economics are, that is, it is economically unviable for someone to cut their tree because of your market disincentives, and the practical effect is that no one will cut their trees.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, let me state again that the object here is to direct the Department of Revenue and the Department of Forestry to balance the disincentives and the incentives so that two, perhaps, out of 3 acres would be grown to an older age. And that implies necessarily that the other acre is cut at a younger age. It will not be cut, I don't believe, Representative Hill, if it's not economically reasonable to do that. Why would a private owner do that? He wouldn't. He's got all the choices, he or she or whatever. He's got all the choices in the world. So it's part of the structure of this initiative that it is economically feasible to cut at an early age, earlier than 95, substantially earlier than 95.
In terms of in your effort to go out and work with experts in crafting this initiative, are you looking in terms of how Oregon currently funds governmental services and the relationship between those services and timber in certain communities in terms of the fees that are paid and how it funds schools in certain areas, in terms of in the relationship of how the effect of what your initiative may place on that if there is a marked disincentive, not a complete prohibition of people cutting trees, but a reduction of it and what the impact that might be on schools? Are you going to have your experts look at that as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, the short answer is yes, we're looking at that. One of the things that we are going to do is to hire an economic consulting firm to look at all of those aspects. But we're certainly familiar with the issues, and let me talk to two of those. One is that there's an existing pattern of harvest and privilege taxes in Oregon that apply to all private owners, somewhat differently to small woodlot owners and somewhat differently to large corporate owners. And we're going to leave all of that in place. So the funds that flow from those taxes will continue to flow to the same recipients that get them now. So, for example, in harvest taxes, some of that money goes to dedicated forestry kinds of things, fire funds and research funds and so on. The money will still go there. And there's part of the privilege tax that's distributed to counties for, various and sundry public uses, and those monies will still go there. If our economic study indicates that that will be depressed somewhat because of a lessened degree of cutting in the early period, then one of the things we might do is to take a portion of the disincentive and supplement the final harvest taxes as they currently exist. Our initial look at that is that thinnings will be high in the early period. They're taxed at the old harvest and privilege tax rates, and we believe that we will not have a substantial downturn in incomes. But we don't know that. We've got to model it, and we are going to do that.
How are we coming on time? Are you getting about? Do I want to finish this up around 10? So
I have perhaps 3 or 4 minutes after the question period, Mr. Chairman, and
I guess I have one question. How is the strategy going to be out there to sell this to the public to get the signatures? How are you going to package this whole plan? We're going to make old growth out of all the trees in Oregon, or what is the package?
Mr. Chairman, I think the package is very simple. What you see is what you get. We're going to package it just as it is. What we're going to say to people is that we need more emphasis in the state on protecting public resources, air, water, soil productivity, fisheries and wildlife. We have to protect those things. And we need to grow real forests, not these toothpick stands that are out there now that are being cut down at 35 and 40 years old. We need to grow real trees like Oregon is capable of growing. Not old growth. Old growth is not 80, 90-year-old trees. We just want to grow a more diverse forest than an older forest, allowing thinnings along the way, and allowing owners choices as to when they would enter and cut. There's nothing complicated and there's nothing duplicitous in the way we intend to market it. We're just going to say we want to reform Oregon's forest practices to protect public resources, public safety, and to grow some real forests out there.
Why don't you go ahead and finish up, and then we'll have more time for some more. George?
I think George will have something after my remarks.
Go ahead, and then we'll have a little bit of another opportunity to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've worked all of my life, except for some minor part-time teaching, in the private sector and in the construction industry. That's an industry where respect for material assets is huge, and where the rights to those assets and the ability to use them freely and when you want to is jealously guarded. My father was in the retail lumber business, and his father before him, and his father before him in Wisconsin, in vertically integrated companies in which they logged and milled and sold the lumber. Construction has been my life and my heritage. Now, when I began this presentation earlier this morning, I said that our common assets, which are air, water, soils, fish, and wildlife, safety, and security, are inexcusably degraded. Inexcusably. That's strong language to me. And I want to talk about that. To me, our current situation in the woods, in the forest, is as if the capital assets of an incredibly prosperous and productive construction firm, we'll call this firm Mother Nature, Inc., Mother Nature, had been allowed to be depleted, and much of the productive equipment had been allowed to rust and decay. And in consequence, the workers' attitudes have turned to cynicism and apathy, like the logger looking at the riparian areas, it doesn't work. So that all that's left is excuse-making caretakers looking at wasted assets, assets not doing the productive work that they're capable doing, saying that they're not responsible. That is inexcusable, and we have to fix it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. George, do you have something to add?
Thank you. My name, again, is George Hutchinson. I'm from the Medford area, where trees grow a lot slower than they do up here in the rainy north. We live in what we call the banana belt, although this winter you wouldn't know it. My interest in Oregon's forest began in the middle of 1985 when I began regularly commuting from Portland to Medford via air and via little 1- and 2-engine planes where I flew relatively close to the ground. What I noticed from a completely uninformed point of view was a checkerboard pattern, which over the ensuing years seemed to be changing from a lot of green squares to an awful lot of brown squares and fewer and smaller green squares. It seemed to indicate that a lot was going on in Oregon's woods. I got interested in this initiative process in forest reform when I lived out in Williams in the 90s, early 90s, actually it was 1990, 89 and 90. And I saw a tremendous amount of what I considered overcutting out there. And the neighbors were very concerned about what was going on in their backyard. And then, in 1995, an initial initiative group came up and proposed what eventually became the ballot measure, which went down to defeat last year. I was interested in it. I didn't work very hard for it because even in 1995, I thought it had some flaws, some serious flaws. This group is remarkably different from that group. there is virtually no one on this group that has ever worked on that other initiative other than we're very aware of it. This group went for research, went for inclusion, went for talking to people on the ground, includes people that own a lot of land on the ground, includes foresters, includes economists, fish and wildlife biologists, political scientists, construction guys, academics. It's a pretty amazing group. And though you wouldn't tell it from couldn't tell it from us three, there's a number of women actively participating in this group too. We've had hearings all over the state for 3 years. Some of our gurus, if you will, have been Dave Perry and Ken Swanson, Ken Carlone from the Oregon State University School of Forestry. Some have been like Roy Keane and Orville Camp, practicing on-the-ground foresters. Yes, they're progressive foresters. Yes, they're trying to maintain the viability of the lands they manage as diligently as they can. We think we're doing as good a job as we can, given the amount of intelligence we have and the time we have. I would like to study this for the rest of my life. I wish we had the time. I think Tom's clearly pointed out, and many of you are aware, that our fish runs are crashing, water quality, particularly in Salem, impacted by overcutting. We have to act. It's not happening quickly enough to save our resources. We need to get our salmon back. We have to take some action to do that. My interest, though, is not so much salmon, guys. If we don't have healthy, viable, non-compacted, non-eroded soils, forget the salmon, forget the trees, forget the forest. It's over. And you can look around the planet in the development of human civilization and find out a number of the civilizations, a number of countries even now, have so woefully mismanaged their productive lands that they can't take care of themselves any longer, that they suffer incredible floods, horrible droughts, tremendous hunger. We needn't do that. We're pretty smart people, all of us, you guys. Particularly, you're sitting up there. You make the policy changes. I sat in yesterday for a three-hour meeting with the BLM. I've been meeting along with a group of interested forest activists in Southern Oregon. We call ourselves the Southern Oregon Forest Coalition. It's eight different watershed and environmental groups. And we've been meeting with the BLM and exchanging information now for the last 8 months. We meet twice a month for about 3 hours each week, so that's 6 hours a month. Plus, we have innumerable emails and letters going back and forth between us. We sit in that with several aides from the Senator Wyden's office. People down there are interested in doing the very best they can with the lands. We're not talking to the BLM about stopping cutting. We're talking about doing the job right. Richard Hart sat there yesterday. He's a world-renowned soil scientist. And he sat with George Padura, who's a retired USFS soil scientist, and those two men were talking about a number of plots they had made on the ground after particular cuts had been made on Southern Oregon's thin granitic soils. Richard uses a device he calls an Honest Abe, which is a high-technological device, which is a brand-new shiny copper Lincoln penny glued onto the top of a 20-penny nail, and he pounds it into the ground, right down flush, after a cut. And then he watches it and measures it as the rainfalls come. After 5 inches on one particular site, he noticed a full inch of that topsoil, not duff, topsoil was gone. 5 inches. That's about 2 weeks' rain in a heavy winter period down in Southern Oregon. That's scary, folks. It scared the hell out of me just looking at it. We can't allow that to continue to happen. We have to do smarter forest practices. That's why I'm here. That's why I wanted you all to hear what this man had to say. I'd love it if you'd have Roy Keane and some of the foresters and some of the fellows from Oregon State University come and fill you in a lot greater depth on the science. I'd love it if you fellows would listen to the various economists we have working with us. One fellow's name's Ernie Naimi. Can I say that name, I hope?
Sure.
Ernie is the fellow who did the economic analysis for President Clinton's various proposed forest plans, one of which became federal law. Whew. It is time to act. I would love it if you fellows would take this and run with it, because I've given 3.5 years to this, my volunteer time, 10 to 20 hours a week. Christ, I'm a teacher. I need to stay focused on my family and my kids and not have to do this kind of thing. I'd love to have a legislature that would. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. We're representing, now we have just a few questions. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is, why didn't you bring it to the legislature? I mean, you're sitting here talking to us about your concept and that you're going to go off into an initiative. We're bright, you refer to us as bright and intelligent policymakers, but yet you're going to go run off and do this without any input, without any compromise, without you're going to put your initiative up. This process is a collaborative process. There are people who come here, and we amend bills all the time. We're going to go amend this next little bill over here because someone had some concern about it. You're presenting an all-or-nothing approach to this. And I don't know, are you going to go for a initiative, or are you going to go for a constitutional amendment on this?
Well, Mr. Hill, to respond to the first part of that, and I bet the other two are going to have something to say, too, the part of the collaborative process would be us being here today. We asked to come here. And your chair was interested in us being here. And I give both of us pats on the back for that. We didn't, at least I didn't, want to come to you folks until with a half-baked idea. This may not be fully done. It's not out of the oven yet, which is why we're here. We are seriously going to take, I want you to hear again, your questions to Tom, I wrote down. Okay? Mr. Byers' questions to Tom, I wrote down. You guys are pretty critical of what we're doing. I get that. But your criticism has merit. We'll take those things into account. Again, we're not done. This isn't cast in stone by any means. We're not ready, and probably won't be for several more months, darn it, to submit this to the Secretary of State. We thought we were ready last year. But we keep getting more and more information. We keep getting a little smarter and a little smarter. Right. And a little better informed. Huh?
You want to say something, Aaron?
Well, because I testified first, and it was early in the morning, I think about 50% of the committee was here, Mr. Chair. My remarks were intended to indicate that there are processes ongoing in Oregon right now which have been described as reforming forest practices, in particular the Oregon Plan. To restore salmon runs. However, as I indicated in my testimony, which at least you all have printed copies of, many citizens view these processes as highly likely to result in very inadequate measures. And that is why the Sierra Club, which I'm here as a representative of, as opposed to respect our resources, is looking with great interest at a ballot initiative. Or as supporting a ballot initiative if one comes forward. What's the current process is described by Representative Hill as collaborative aren't working.
Representative Beyer, then we're going to need to be closing.
Oh, Representative Thompson. Okay. Keep going by you.
Yeah, I assume that's fine.
And Representative Beyer, we need to be closing down.
First thing is, you know, I realize what you want to accomplish, but I worry sometimes when you take a blanket approach to anything like this. It's happened in the initiative process, and then it comes to us, and we have to try to make it into something that's implementable. We're having trouble with initiative now in 66. We've had many initiatives that have had trouble because it puts a financial burden on us, and I appreciate what Representative Hill did. And I worry also, just like in forest practices, when you go out and mandate things, an initiative, and it's done on a broad base, I don't care how you work in the environment, it's tough to deal with broad base because everything is an individual situations. I don't care whether it's that one stream where you had that narrow band and it was overcut. In another area, it was shaded and situations were different in the soil. It might not have been overcut. I worry about this situation that where you're talking about a broad-based initiative because it's going to run into all kinds of problems if it was to get passed. Let me give you an example. You made a broad-based statement just a minute ago. The salmon are in poor state. Are you aware that in the south part of the coast, we have the highest coho ratings in years coming off of forest lands? In the central part of the coast, we have the highest Chinook stocks we've had in years coming off of forest lands. I mean, that's a broad-based statement, but it isn't true everywhere. And so I'll make this comment to you. Be careful, because when you go to a broad-brush approach, instead of trying to work on it collaboratively with all the players, I think we may end up with a disaster on our hands instead of something we're all looking for.
Okay, Representative Byron, that'll be the last comment, and we'll close down.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson's comments. Ironically, Representative Thompson, the economics of the forest industry are such that what we have now is a broad-based, uniform practice on the landscape. The economics are such that we have accountant-driven forestry, and we cut down the forest at an age of 30 to 50 years. With very few exceptions, that's what's happening everywhere. What we're trying to do is introduce some diversity into this broad-based, uniform practice. So not only do I accept your statement that we need diversity, I think I'm actually promoting it. I think this initiative does that and gets away from the uniform condition that we have on the landscape now. Thank you very much.
One brief comment. That's exactly what the Stammen Plan's trying to do.
Representative Beyer and then Representative Rubelaw has talked me into one short question.
This could go on a while.
He said she's been too quiet today.
Yes, she has. Did the Sierra Club support Measure 64?
Want me to explain that one?
I'm sure you go into.
We had a great deal of difficulty coming to a very marginally supportive position. A number of Sierra Club activists were involved in signature gathering. I did everything in my power, short of strangling Gary Kucher, to keep Measure 64 off the ballot. I nonetheless was leading the thinking that if they're going to put it on, a tremendous number of Sierra Club activists have been involved. I do not want to abandon our troops. Therefore, we will reluctantly endorse. We gave them no money, and we did give Gary Kucher space in the state conifer to explain his position. And that, so that is as thorough an answer as I know to give you, Representative Beyer.
I guess the comment would be, so the same many people that you keep talking about that are so disenfranchised with the system, the collaborative process going through on these in the legislative or administrative arena, would these be the same many people who voted then for Measure 64?
No, I think it would be a much, Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I think it would be a much larger number of people than voted for Measure 64. Few things turned out to be as unpopular as Measure 64 at the ballot box, as we know. Look at the makeup of the Board of Forestry, which plays a pivotal role in all these collaborative processes because it must ultimately pass the rules that the collaborative processes are supposed to produce. You see a very high representation for the timber industry, four of the seven members of the board, no angling representation whatsoever, and a little bit of environmental representation. We don't think that reflects the hearts and minds of the population of Oregon as a whole. So that means that we think that most of the people in Oregon are disenfranchised from the current structure of what's described as a collaborative process, but seems to be a process that is not likely to really result in a product that reflects public opinion.
And when 20% of the people will vote for a poorly conceived, unfair proposition out of their true concern for the environment, we think well better than 50% plus one will vote for a well-thought-through, fair, revenue-neutral proposition that goes a long way towards saving, protecting, conserving the resources of which we're concerned.
I'll be interested to see the revenue neutrality that you propose, and I'm just curious to know how you're going to address all the unemployed people from your initiative.
Representative Rubelaw. Time is going.
Yes, and this is very fast. I've listened to more than several comments about the collaborative process, and in general, talking about why don't you bring this to the legislature instead of the initiative, I think we need a little truth in process. And what I want to say is that I have railed against some of the initiatives out there. I think Measure 5 has put us in a terrible position and should have been done differently. But the truth is that many, many good ideas come to the legislature. But because we have a committee process where the committee chairs determine what is heard and what is not heard, and for many times for not very good reasons except political reasons, it is difficult to get involved in the collaborative process, and that is our failing, not yours. And so citizens do have to go around the barn, so to speak. And I think that needs to be out on the table, and we need to recognize that.
Thank you. We're going to close the hearing. We thank you for coming. We really appreciate it. We've had a good day, I think, all of us, and really appreciate you coming and bringing your proposal. We will be following this as closely as all the citizens of Oregon, and you need any help from any of the people on the committee as their advice, whether you think you have a good idea or not, I'm sure these people will speak up. There's no one timid here.
We got that.
And,
Mr. Chair, I would also encourage you to, once you get your draft, to take advantage of the fact that Legislative Council will draft your initiative for you, and they will find issues that you may not have thought of, rather than just, you know, using the kitchen table and a crayon approach and leaving the fix to us.
County Commissioner Johnson has rejected that very strongly also.
Thank you again for coming. We have 3490, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3496. We have the -1 amendment. As you remember, this was the issue that Representative Lundquist brought to us, dealing with the game bird preserves and expanding the acreage in eastern Oregon. In section 3, 9 through 22, we had the wrong reference, the wrong statute, and so I believe we have the amendments here to straighten this out.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1.
Okay, Representative Hill moves the -1. Any discussion? Anyone opposing?
Yeah, I do have one question, Mr. Chair. I don't remember it being discussed at the original meeting, and maybe it was, and I just don't have my notes. But one comment I had made to myself is, why are we charging such a low fee to non-residents? I mean, I think we ought to go get those non-residents. They don't have to pay sales tax or anything else when they come into the state and they're using our resources.
As I understand, the issue is this is private land. We were hunting birds that were raised privately.
Right.
And
but they still have to get a license or ticket or permit or whatever we call it.
In most cases, they also have to pay for the birds. The private land.
Because they're paying a fee to hunt on private property.
Yeah, and I realize that.
So this is a canned bird hunt?
No fair chase.
Yes, but these birds do fly over the fences.
Okay.
Anyone opposed to the amendment?
An
amendment passed. We need a motion to move the bill in.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3496 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Anyone opposed?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cromwell.
I do have some questions, but because Representative Lundquist isn't here, I'm not going to be able to ask those. I will reserve the right. I'll give it a courtesy vote out, but I do reserve the right to vote no on the floor.
Nobody here. We can do what we want.
Anyone opposed? Samantha, show everyone voting that and supporting. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3496. We'll have Representative Lundquist carry his bill. And
question to the floor.
Move to the floor. Thank you. We are adjourned.